Good evening. Can everybody hear me clearly? I'm very happy for the invitation from New York Insight and all the volunteers and countless people who make this center possible to run for so many years. And also, especially to you who are interested in these programs, and especially tonight. I'd like to invite us at the beginning of our time together into a few minutes of silence. And in these few minutes of silence, I'd like us to contemplate why we are here. Is it just because, Friday evening you have nothing else to do, or you're curious, what is this? Or is it especially this topic of spiritual bypassing, when we experience in meditation? Experiences like, oh, this is something I don't want to discover, I don't want to look at, I don't want to experience. Which I think, let me ask, is there anybody who does not have experienced? I wouldn't say every time we sit, but numerous times, things, we discover things in meditation and the practice we don't want to discover actually. And we feel like, oh, we want to turn away from that or want to bypass. And by the way, because this term spiritual bypassing is used by different people in different meanings, I invite us tonight to ideally free ourselves from any preconceived ideas what this might be or not, but maybe just be open to an exploration what this might be. So the invitation in these few minutes of silence is, on one hand, to really arrive. I mean, our bodies obviously have arrived already, but really to fully arrive in the body and mind, sitting here, breathing, feeling the body, and so on. Basically, cultivating mindfulness, here and now awareness. But then also look at your motivation. Why did you come here tonight? And then also, touching that topic, what understanding do you have? Spiritual bypassing, kind of. Forgive me, please, English is not my native language, as you can hear. So, is there a different or more precise word for bypassing? Kind of moving around, like what? That image comes to my mind when you have a bypass operation, some pipe or some essential line or street is blocked. I mean, in road we call a detour, right? But then we look for a different way around a difficulty or a clogged or obstacle or something, And this might be a very wise approach. So we should look not just in terms of, oh, this is something wrong or bad or unskillful, sometimes it might be very wise to, maneuver, move around a certain difficulty when something is clogged or blocked. And then when we don't want to look at things, there's also the experience, yeah, I feel so troubled by life. Life is so stressful that in meditation, in formal practice specifically, I really look for a place of rest and peace. If I learn through the skill of mindfulness and collectedness of mind, concentration, to settle the mind on something like the breathing, it gives a relief for that time, especially if I have developed the skill to develop deeper levels of samadhi, of concentration, of settling the mind. It's like leaving the world behind for the time of that practice. Totally legitimate to a certain extent, but of course, once we end that kind of focusing the mind on that object, like the breathing or whatever it might be, the old stuff comes back. Life welcomes us back, And whatever dukkha, suffering, challenges we experience, it just comes right with us because it dwells in our heart and minds, We know that. So let's look in these few minutes of silence settling the mind, maybe we sit 10, 12 minutes or so, and I will hopefully remember throughout our 2 hours, a little bit less than 2 hours, to have periods of silence to let that settle what we hear or might share, you know, and we will be invited at some point to contribute also, you know, your thoughts, your ideas, your questions. Because in my experience, especially as an insight dialogue teacher, maybe that was not so much mentioned, that the wisdom of the group, of the Sangha, is often much deeper than the wisdom of a single being. There are exceptions to that, like, you know, the Buddha would sit here or other awakened, enlightened teachers. Now, in my case, the truth is there's more wisdom in the group than from the person sitting here and talking, you know. That's not a secret to those who know me, and you find out soon. You know? So, and by the way, why did I choose this topic? Maybe or perhaps monastics are quite skillful in spiritual bypassing, the lifestyle they choose, you know, intentionally avoiding to deal with certain things. But I tell you, since I came back to the West from Thailand, especially since a few years since I tried to establish a small center with a lot of worldly responsibilities, I feel like a domestic monastic. You know, it's quite different living in a forest monastery with very well support or living in the midst of a small spa town in northern Germany, in my hometown actually, my parents' house, and try to establish a center there. There's a lot of things I would like to bypass. And to be honest, a lot of things I have so much resistance and aversion to. So please be very clear. I'm not speaking from a position, you know, I'm above there, I have mastered these things and talking down to you. No. So let's explore this together and enjoy this period of silence to really settle in the here and now and to look at our motivation, intention, and also understanding of this topic of spiritual bypassing and when we don't want to look in meditation of what's happening or what's relevant in our lives. Does it make a difference when we sit a few minutes in silence like this? Cultivating mindfulness, sati, presence of mind in the here and now. Feeling the body as it's experienced, whether with pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And feeling the mind states, emotions, whether they are comfortable or not, pleasant or not, agreeable or not. It's mindfulness, as the name says, fullness of the mind, not foolishness. Presence. Knowing what is. Not what we like or prefer to experience. The practice of insight meditation, vipassana, is inviting us in a certain way to embrace in this moment to be open for anything. It does not mean that we take later action or make effort to weaken or let go of unwholesome mind states or experiences, or ideally let them not arise in the first place, or that we make an intentional effort to make wholesome mind states to arise, and once they are there, to strengthen them, to stabilize them, to make them stronger. This is known as right effort. So I invite us to please open our eyes in case we have them closed and see how that changes our practice. Though many of us might be used to sit with closed eyes in formal meditation, it's interesting when the Buddha talks about body posture. You know, there is this sitting with cross legs mentioned, sitting upright, establishing mindfulness in front of oneself, but no mentioning about the eyes. Interesting. And in other traditions, actually, it's advised sometimes to sit with open eyes. A tool device like a bell can be extremely dangerous. Dangerous in terms of if we hear this potentially beautiful sound of a bell, and we have the idea meditation ends now, or starts. Yes, maybe, you know, a certain specific period of meditation starts or ends. But please, in terms of continuation of mindfulness, it would be fatal to have the idea, you know, meditation ends or starts with the sound of a bell. We might agree in our, you know, thinking or view, but if I'm honest, I often have this idea, you know, oh, you know, now the formal meditation silence is over. I mean, I'm talking already since a few minutes, but talking or thinking does not need to stop or end the meditation. So when we explore a topic like spiritual bypassing, when we don't want to look, I think it's really valuable to look at experiences in meditation, and not just in formal meditation, of what we don't like to experience. Or, you know, when I say look, that means stands for experience. And I just want to open to a few, to the group, just to hear a variety of experiences. So just name briefly with a few words, what would you prefer not to experience or look at in meditation? It could be, of course, the traditional five hindrances, certain emotions, whatever. Just to get a sense of what's present here, what we don't like to experience in meditation. So I just like to open the space, and if a number of you would just share with a word, a single word, or a few words, what is it you experience in meditation you don't like to look at or experience? Please.
And I have the mics for those who want to share. Judgment.
Oh, I just started learning. I don't have anything to share. Sorry.
Physical pain.
Mm.
physical pain?
General irritation.
I don't like it when it's too hot. Well, I don't like it when it's too hot in the room, so.
Anger.
Worries.
Contraction.
Frustration.
Frenetic thoughts.
Feeling the scarcity of time.
Falling asleep and dreaming and not realizing it.
Anger.
Daydreaming.
Anxiety. Anxiety, anxious.
Sadness and anger.
Judgment.
My part in my own suffering and that of others.
Physical discomfort.
When your feet fall asleep.
Restlessness.
Intrusive thoughts.
I actually don't have anything. I don't really like meditation. I actually pretty much enjoy everything comes along with meditation. So I don't know, like, you know, the sadness or frustration can be mm-hmm. a good part of it as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mountain?
Selfishness, harm I cause others.
Sorry, me again. I just thought something that I don't like. My understanding for meditation is my mind really come to a peaceful status. What I don't like is I know I need to make it peaceful, but my monkey mind is jumping all over the place.
I practice with rumination of unpleasant thoughts and, yeah.
Shame.
I don't like running through my to-do list.
Carlos.
Okay. I could add feeling arrogant, identifying with what's happening, taking things personal, attachment. And a lot of the things which I've heard from you, there was a kind of resonance and saying, yes, same. I don't know how it was for you. It was a lot of the things you heard, you know. So then another question is, if we name these things which we don't like to look at or experience, is there a way to avoid them, to bypass, you know? And again, would this be skillful or not? For instance, pain, you know, if we can sit, stand, walk, or lie in a way which would make pain not to arise, great. But we know whatever position we choose, when we sit longer, sooner or later it will come. And it seems to be really part and parcel of formal meditation, unless, you know, we fiddle around every, whatever, couple of seconds or minutes. But even that is not really, you know, avoiding, yes, maybe immediate strong pain, but how successful it is to bypass, to trying to avoid. Really, I invite us to look at this, our inner attitude. Do we cultivate with our understanding of meditation a picking and choosing process? Let me call it this, you know. I like this, want to experience this. I don't like that, I want to avoid that. This is why I'm meditating. How many of us want to get rid of this monkey mind? Or how many, and I don't necessarily ask for hands now, I'm using often questions as a way of investigation, you know, so I don't expect an answer or a hand sign necessarily. So when the mind gets calm at times and it stays calm, how many of us at some point feel like, oh, we want more activity in the mind, because just being calm, you know, the mind is calm now, and with this experience of so what, or what now, you know, what to do with this calmness. Many wish for us maybe to come to that state, but what is that saying in English? The grass of the other side of the fence always looks greener, you know. When the mind is very active, you know, we look for a calm mind. When the mind is very calm, we look maybe for a skillful engagement with for the mind, you know, to cultivate the wholesome. I find it quite surprising when I look at my own practice over the years that still there seems to be an underlying tendency of having a gut feeling or judgment. If I suffer, if there's some difficulty there, some problem, there's something wrong with the practice. I don't like it, you know. But come on, this is the first noble truth. That was the Buddha was pointing to, you know, the truth of dukkha. And rather than calling it suffering, I prefer to describe dukkha. Dukkha is all that what is not ultimately, lastingly, or permanently satisfying. That's quite a bit. It's not just what is uncomfortable, painful, as we know. Even pleasant experiences, noble mind states, as they are impermanent, they will not offer ultimately lasting happiness, fulfillment. This is the truth. This is the first, or depends how we look at it, the second characteristic the Buddha was describing, besides impermanence. So, in our mind or thinking, we can agree to this, but the gut feeling is, my so-called, my gut feeling is, I want to experience something which is stable, which offers safety, which offers a refuge, you know. So that's the word refuge, you know. Do we take refuge, or do we go for refuge to the Buddha, to awakening? Is this the essential, an essential part of our practice? Do we go for refuge to the Dharma, to that what upholds itself, to the truth, the teaching of the Buddha, or natural laws, depends how you define or look at Dharma? Do we go for refuge to the Sangha? We probably have experienced, and I don't know details, but I know any community I lived in, whether monastery or mixed, whatever, there were problems, challenges, So Sangha, in terms of community of practice, like we are a community here this evening, is probably not the most safe and secure refuge. The ultimate refuge of Sangha is this community of awakened or partially awakened beings. Now, I don't know how many of us are there here. Actually, I should be careful when I say things like that. How many of us? I would be happy if there is at least one or two or more. I don't know. I have certain assumptions, or, you know, I'm not speaking from a perspective of an awakened being sitting here and sharing what I'm sharing right now. And if there would be such a person, maybe we should change seats, you know. It would be great. I would be happy to, you know, listen to an awakened or partially awakened being sharing the Dharma. I find really the inner attitude, motivation, I think it's part of right view, right understanding, is crucial. How we relate to our practice and how we experience our practice, our life. When we look at the Noble Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth the Buddha was describing, as the way to eliminate dukkha, the way to realize the Third Noble Truths, or to really deeply understand the Second Noble Truths, you know, these different kinds of desires, of wishes, of drives, which make us behave unskillful. The Noble Eightfold Path as the path of practice is, in my understanding, holistic. It does not exclude anything. Or, in short form, and I don't know how much this is shared here, of course, explained for sure, but not few people in the West, we sometimes put down the practice of sila, you know, the practice of, how to call it, morality, of an ethical kind of behavior which does not harm myself or others. We put that often down. No, we are interested in the meditation, in the real stuff, you know, oh, kind of ethical stuff, you know, commandments, and we know from other, you know, Christian, Jewish stuff or whatever, you know. No, we want to go for the real deep wisdom stuff. But be careful. When we do not make, and by the way, when I talk, these are reflections about the Dharma based on my own practice or what I understand from the Buddha's teaching. Feel completely free to disagree. Don't believe. Or ideally also don't disbelieve, but take it as an invitation to check, find out for yourself, you know. But I really have to admit that I underestimate the power of the practice of meditation of sila, because it's such a crucial part of our life, the way we deal with ourselves and others and in relationship. Why does the Buddha mention these three factors, you know, like right speech, right action, and mind and livelihood? They are so central in our life. And when we sit in silence, of course, stuff comes up from these areas. The way we communicate, now much more complex, you know, not just speaking and listening. You have all these devices, all these possibilities of skillful or unskillful behaviors. And there are powerful people, not just in this country, but especially in this country, who through a few words can, phew, do I refer to a certain person here, I wonder. Words, communication have power, tremendous power. In a wholesome or unwholesome direction, we can use words, communication, to transmit wisdom, which can lead to liberation, to deep insight, to deep understanding, to deep penetration of how things are. We can use words which can lead to disharmony, to fights, to wars, to crimes, to rape, misuse, abuse, you know, racism, and world wars. And all the scope, you know, from wholesome to unwholesome, from unwholesome to wholesome, and what's in between. The Buddha mentions numerous times in his discourses, you know, the power to endure unskillful, harsh words when they're addressed to us. Or maybe they're not addressed to us personally, you know, but how do we deal with this? Then the right actions or unskillful actions. When we sit in silence, and often, you know, it's sitting or walking meditation practice formally, what comes up often in these so-called monkey mind activities is our daily life, or not. When we have behaved in a way which is not skillful, remorse maybe comes up. Naturally. Why does the Buddha call these qualities of Hiri and Otapa, and the translation of these qualities is sometimes not so pleasant to hear, moral dread and shame is sometimes translations, but they are protective. Like when we regret something, it might feel not pleasant at all in this moment when we remember something unskillful we have said, done, or thought in our mental states. But they might be powerful forces to motivate us not to do so in the future, to refrain from that. So if we want to avoid, for example, remorse, regretting, is this skillful or not? If you want not to experience it. Now, when the mind is peaceful, calm, I don't have to regret anything because my way of living with myself, with others, in interaction, is free from remorse. The Buddha actually teaches a whole sequence, you know. If there's freedom from remorse, there is no need for an act of will to experience joy, happiness, tranquility, rapture, concentration. One thing leads to the other, to see things as they are, and that leads to disenchantment, and that leads to liberation of mind, actually. It starts all with that experience of a mind which has freedom from remorse. So when we do experience, for example, remorse, this could be the very experience which leads us to an interest in a practice which leads us to freedom from remorse. An attempt to calm the mind is often a direct confrontation with the noise of the mind, right? When it's still, we notice how noisy it is, the mind, not the aircon just, but when we try to clean something, we focus on the dirt, right? So, when we have that experience of, oh, how terrible is this to experience? When we want to cultivate wakefulness and we experience sleepiness, welcome in the practice. When we want to be free from greed, hate, delusion, and we experience exactly those same things, welcome on the path of practice or in the path of practice. Of course, if something is tremendously overwhelming or brings up traumatic experiences, it might be very skillful in this moment, if it's overwhelming too much, to avoid that. To really take careful action in our practice to not trigger certain traumas. I have not have experienced certain trainings in how to deal with trauma, and so there's a number of wonderful teachers here which share the practice here, which you can address like this, you know. But we know when something is overwhelming and we know there's a trigger and what might trigger that, to carefully, skillfully, compassionately, kindly avoid this. And there might be situations, for example, in the relationship to a therapist or something like this, where it might be skillful to look at that. You know, but even then, great care, great experience, great skill is necessary for that. This feeling of failure. I have practiced for so long. Some people say when they practice a couple of weeks, that's so long. Some people say a couple of months or years or decades. I sometimes, looking at some people I know, and I take as an example, for example, this beloved teacher and friend of mine, Bhante Gunaratana, Henepula Gunaratana, Bhante Ji, he's often referred to. I don't know. He was teaching here in the past, I think. Is that so? Yeah? So he turns, I think, this year, 93. He has been for 73 years a fully ordained Buddhist monk, and a number of years, I don't know how many, a novice monk before. So has he been probably over 75, 80 years in robes. So that's pretty long period of practice, and intensely, you know, and this is a really wise teacher from my point of view. So compared to him, I'm pretty junior, you know, just whatever, 3 decades or so of practice. So one can become quite humble, you know, when with the struggles one has. So when we practice long, whatever our understanding of long is, and we feel, we judge actually, there is something wrong because I'm still dealing with lust, with aversion, with anxiety, with strong judgments. And often it feels like these things seem to get stronger or more intense. Now, is that true or not? It's worthwhile investigating, but what often happens is we become much more sensitive. I think there's a Tibetan saying that a grain of sand on the palm of our hand is not a big deal, but a grain of sand in the eye is a big deal. Yeah? So when our path develops and we become more sensitive, we get more sensitive to pain, not just to pleasure. Pleasure in terms of, in a Dharma sense, you know. It hurts more when we or other people are unskillful. And sometimes the hurt is felt so intensely that it feels like it's too much. Yeah. And I'm not an expert of this. In certain stages of insight, 16 stages of insight which are described, there is, for example, an insight stage of insight where there's a strong perception of everything is falling apart, ending, you know. And that's, to be with that is quite disheartening. I think it's far too smooth to describe that. I don't find, to be honest, the appropriate word, but people I've talked to who have experienced that in a deep way, quite unstabilizing maybe to a certain extent, because you can hold on to, you cannot hold on to anything. When that of dissolution, you know, is so present, nothing is stable, everything falls apart. Safety is basically gone. There's no more safety. And that's a stage of insight, and it needs really a skillful teacher often to go through this, to deal with this skillfully, because often I heard people get so disheartened with that they give up the practice maybe, or want to return to earlier stages of insight. So these, coming back to these 3 factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, speech, or we can understand speech in a wider way, communication, action, you know, which often refers in terms of morality teachings, ethical behavior. How do we deal with general way of harming? I mean, non-killing is one thing, but non-harming, to be more refined, has so many deep levels, you know, so many different ways of practice. Stealing or not taking what is not given. Materially, that's one thing, but what about our mental attitudes, you know, the way we judge or are judged? And then our sexual behavior, or the exact wording actually the Buddha used in the third precepts, kame sumichachara, means the wrong uses of the senses I undertake the training to avoid. And that has developed historically more into sexual misconduct. Now, what does that mean? You know, how much comes up in my life, in my meditation, where I look at my sexual behavior, what I've done, spoken, or thinking. Now, sometimes people are surprised when they hear that Buddhist monastics, we are doing confessions regularly. You know, when you live in a community and you have the confession every fortnight, you have the actual recitation of the rules before we are invited to confess with another monk. So it's basically the invitation to look at your behavior, what you have done in the last fortnight, and in some monasteries that's practiced actually daily, a powerful reflection. What have I done? And the Buddha was very wise, invited us to look at our way of speaking and acting. This is what we really do, what we can hear or see. But he was so wise that we don't need to confess our thoughts. Now, can you imagine if we would need to confess our thoughts? That's, for many of us, an endless story, you know. I remember when I lived in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa at Wat Suan Mok in Thailand, he developed once a practice which he called Dhamma Lab Book. The lab stands for laboratory. What's the English pronunciation? And he, every couple of hours or so, wrote, what is the English word, meticulously, down any thoughts or unwholesome mind states which entered his mind. Now, I tried this and I gave up very quick because it was so frustrating, you know, when you pay attention to any unwholesome thought or mind state which arises when it's your mind is full of them. So I needed to adapt that somehow, you know, but anyway, I gave it up very quick. But this can be, it's basically taking stock of what's happening, you know. Sometimes when we practice a way of labeling, you know, can be skillful. We get an idea of what's happening in the mind when we label thoughts, for instance. Taking stock, what's happening? So, thoughts are very powerful because they lead possibly to speaking or to actions, and thoughts are actions, as you know, the Buddha was teaching, you know. Intention is karma, is action, yeah, thoughts. But we don't need to confess them in terms of, that would go too far. But we know the power, you know. If I have a judgment about you, you know, what a wonderful human being you are. That does something to myself for sure and to our relationship, and maybe you feel something also. If I have a judgment, you know, what an idiot are you, you know? Sitting down, closing your eyes, trying to find the truth. This is not the truth. This is avoiding life. Navel gazing. These Buddhists, you know. Look what happens in a country like Myanmar, you know, or Sri Lanka, or, you know, Tibet and power structures. Yes, Buddhism seemed to have had or has still a certain good reputation, but there's enough examples in the Buddhist history countries, including the West, as you know, full of scandals and unskillful behavior. Welcome in life of human beings. The problem is, you can say in the Buddha's teaching, there's no way that we can justify through the Buddha's teaching any acts of violence with thinking, speaking, or acting out. You know, the Buddha said, you know, kill the kilesas. Yes, but that's not a justification, you know, to kill somebody who is so unskillful in his behavior that he harms others, you know. There might be, and again, later teachings, Mahayana, Vajrayana, have developed certain different understandings which are, might be quite contrary to a certain extent to the original teachings. And I don't want to just, I want to just mention that but not enter that kind of discussion. As I'm reflecting, sharing these thoughts with you, you might get a sense of the scope of this, how I understand this topic. It's huge. It's about our life. And I've so far just talked about, you know, mainly, not just, but mainly about right speech, action. So looking at the way we harm or not harm other beings, the way we relate to possessions, sexual behavior, you know, and then again, what we do verbally or with our actions is one thing, but then our mind, you know. How do we consider other beings as sexual objects of attraction or non-attraction, you know? And not just this culture is rich of that, you know, idealism, you know. But in terms of history, how does it change, for instance, what is considered to be beautiful and attractive throughout history? Changes a lot, or culturally, so conditioned, you know, it's so relative. What one culture considers as attractive and beautiful, another culture is, oh no, terrible, you know. How can one, she or he or, you know, whatever is else appropriate. The way of speaking was already mentioned, you know, communication. The power of that. And I think there's good reasons the Buddha mentioned that first. And then the fifth area of the precepts is our relationship to drugs or substances which influence the mind. And again, from a monastic perspective, the Buddha is quite clear in his advice, you know, avoid these things which lead to heedlessness, to carelessness. Not it's all right to, you know, take a little bit when you're not heedless or so. The Buddha's advice was clear. What you do with it, that's up to you. Yeah. And of course, we like to bend or adjust the teachings in a way which feels comfortable to our lifestyle, circumstances, and so on. We have that freedom, yes. But I think it's quite helpful to be quite clear, what did the Buddha originally teach or meant with his teachings, and how do we twist it, maybe adapt it, change it? Yeah. Is this bypassing? You know, when I take the freedom to maybe have a little bit alcohol here and there, or take other substances which open the mind, which make the mind more peaceful? And again, forgive me, but as a monastic, I might have views which you totally disagree with. It's fine. Yeah. By avoiding certain behaviors, by saying no to certain actions, it's often a very direct confrontation with these things. If you don't follow certain urges you want to follow, it's a very strong direct confrontation with something. If you say no to something, you know, like acting out your sexuality or not drinking alcohol or whatever it might be, that's not per se the answer to say, you know, this is the way to deal with it, you know. The truth is, for many of us, it's a path of practice and struggle. For example, to deal with issues of sexuality, power, relationship to consumption, on many levels. Yeah. Or who could honestly, you know, say, "Ah, I've managed that, no more problem." Maybe certain things we have completely experienced a letting go of, being complete free from. But a number of other things we are still struggling with. So what is wrong when we feel, when we experience things in meditation which we don't like? How can we change it? Of course, if we can develop in a way which the Buddha advises in meditation to increase the wholesome mind states, the wholesome qualities, the wholesome actions. The moment you have a wholesome mind state, you act wholesome. In this very moment, you cannot experience something unskillful, unwholesome, in a mind moment or one action. When you smile, for instance, you cannot be angry at that time, even if that smile is fake. You know, there's that saying, if you can't make it, fake it. It's not the ultimate solution, but I mean, try when you're angry and you put on a smile, even though you don't feel like it. At that very moment, you cannot be angry. No way. It doesn't feel nice when you're angry to smile, you know? But it has that effect. That moment you cannot be angry, you know? And it feels fake, artificial. Do we make... I might ramble a bit, forgive me, I will soon end and open the that for you to share. Sometimes with Asian teachers, particularly with Asian teachers, the way they speak about dealing with emotions, you know, like sometimes you should not show emotions, you should be free from emotions. There's sometimes certain comments make me kind of, ooh, kind of feel really, oh. No, this is not how I understand the practice. But the interesting thing is how, with the experience of emotions, that what moves, yeah, motion, movement, how we deal with this, it's quite crucial in our life, not just in our meditation life or Dharma practice, you know. When there are things like anger or depression or, you know, strong experiences of happiness and contentment, joy, sadness, loss, you know, anger, whatever it might be. It was never in my understanding the Buddha's intention not to feel these things, but to have a realistic perspective, not from aloof, but when the Buddha teaches again and again, this is not me, this is not mine, this does not belong to me. It's not the invitation to kind of distance yourself in meeting this experience with aversion or turning away from, but I don't know, certain teachers say it's this beautiful thing, if you hold on to things, you know, this is mine, you know, my, what do you call this? Stroke?
Striker.
This is my striker, you know, I'm attaching to it. Now I want to let go of this. Are you ready for something? An experiment? So I want to get rid of this striker, so I throw it away. But this still comes from kind of I want to get rid of, you know? You can. So is there a way of relating to whatever we experience with this striker, emotions, thoughts, ideas, bodily experiences, mental experiences, that we are in touch with the striker, the emotion, the thought, whatever, but we don't need to cling, So let go is maybe being in touch, but not holding on to. Then I can let it be. But I'm still in touch with it. But it doesn't belong to me. I'm not this. Easy to say. I find this image quite... numerous teachers have shared this. Maybe this is a skillful way of attempting to relate to life in formal meditation and outside of formal meditation. It's not bypassing, you know. It's not this, I must get rid of that strike. I must get rid of that depression, of that anger, of that strong attachment to my joy, you know, my happiness, my success. Look at me, you know, my education, my car, my flat, my collection of with whom I sat a retreat already, you know, my Buddhist, you know, bio, you know, look how long I'm practicing, how long I can sit still, how accurately I can label, or whatever. Anything skillful we can turn into a trap. No question about it. Maybe before I stop, it's one-way communication. Exploring a little bit, when is it skillful to avoid, to bypass? Again, when something is really triggered or something leading us really into unskillful behavior or experiences. Like, people harm themselves sometimes with their understanding of practice when you try to practice in a way which you're not ready for. Even the discourses, you know, it's full of, I don't know full, but this happened a number of times where young monks or nuns or practitioners wanted to go into solitude, into the forest to practice by themselves when they were not ready. The Buddha sometimes advised these young monks, don't do it. And they didn't listen, so they went and they experienced not pleasant or sometimes really harmful things, which damage them sometimes. Skillful to avoid these things, you know. When is the time ready for what? Being inspired by great yogis, by great practitioners is one thing. But to know where we are and what is skillful is another. I think Thich Nhat Hanh once invited into a contemplation, if the Buddha would meet us, if the Buddha would meet you as a practitioner, what do you think he would advise you to practice? If he can look into your mind, into your heart, into your life, what's there? Maybe something which we wouldn't like to be pointed to, you know. Often it's said that's the skill of great teachers. They point us to that what we often don't like to look at or experience or hear. Not per se, you know. Of course, it's an encouragement also of cultivating that what is possible, maybe beyond our imagination. Avoid unskillful places of living, unskillful jobs, livelihood. I have not mentioned about that much, you know. Our profession, or I understand this is an interpretation, livelihood more in terms of our balance of receiving, accepting, being on the receiving end of other people's generosity, and what we share. You know, you heard about dana. Why did the Buddha start to teach about giving, sharing? There's very good reasons for that. But we should avoid giving everything away, you know, being free from attachment, you know. You know, you should look after yourself, after your family, after your possessions. You know, the Buddha is really pragmatic. Is it skillful to avoid practices which we are not ready for yet, you know? Sitting 3 hours motionless. Pain is just an illusion. You know, and then you can damage your knees, your back, your mind possibly. You might remember that simile of the snake, you know, when you grasp the teaching in the wrong way, like you can, when you grasp a snake, you know, take it by its tail, it turns around and bites you. If you take it, grasp it by the head, it will not harm you, even if it's very poisonous. Any skillful thing can be misused. And we should avoid that, of course. It's not a Buddhist teaching, I think, but sometimes it appears in the Buddhist teachings, you know, this, I don't know where it comes from, but, you know, there is that, there's a hole in the street, you walk there and you fall in, you know, and you hardly get out, you know. Next time you fall into that, I might not repeat it correctly, but next time you fall into the hole again, you get out quicker, you don't blame the hole anymore, but, oh, you know. And then, actually I forgot, it's five stages, I think. But then you kind of fall again into the hole, you're much quicker out, you take responsibility. And then the last stage, I think, is you just take another road. You avoid that place, you know. Or you see it clearly, you know, and don't step into it, something like that. So this might be a skillful simile of, you know, bypassing or not. Moving around dangers if they are too dangerous. Avoiding dangerous territory. Dangerous actions. Even so, we might like it to play with the fire. But when we get burned, okay, hopefully we learn our lesson. And when we look at our lifestyle, especially in a place like New York or Manhattan or, you know, what seems normal here for us or for you, from a Dharmic perspective, worthwhile to investigate maybe, you know. Again, the standard of the Buddha, the measure stick, is not if something is pleasant or unpleasant, agreeable or not agreeable, but the measure stick of the Buddha is simply, it's simply to say so, do the wholesome qualities increase or not, and the unwholesome decrease? Then please do it. Engage in that kind of practice. And even if something feels pleasant, if the unwholesome qualities increase and the wholesome qualities decrease, please don't do it. Even if it's accepted by society, lived by millions or billions of people, that's not the measure stick. Yeah. So look at where it's really wise to avoid things, to not engage. Sometimes people say, you know, oh, you should be open for everything and learn from it. Good luck. The Buddha's advice was quite clear. Avoid the unwholesome, you know, environments, actions, people. Not to associate with fools often leads to a lot of reactions by people when they hear that teaching. And again, it depends on the translation, but it's, if somebody who is not wise approaches you, you still act kindly, compassionately towards that person, but you might not choose, you know, to have that friend as your closest buddy. Yeah. So let me stop here, invite us to a few minutes of silence, and then I open the space for your reflections, your experiences, your wisdom, and maybe questions, whatever, comments. Okay? Maybe just 5 minutes silence. before I open the floor to your contributions. I'm very well aware that I spent a lot of time talking about these three practices of the Noble Eightfold Path, like communication, actions, and a little bit about mindfulness, so about the sila aspects of morality. But I think it's really worthwhile because that's the foundation of where we build on the meditative qualities, you know, like right effort, mindfulness, concentration, and also the wisdom aspects of right view and right intention, you know. And yeah, it would take too much time to try to cover these, so I ask for forgiveness about this. So I open the space for your contributions.
Contributions, you said?
Contributions, you can, you know, disagree with what you heard or share your experience, whatever.
So I'd like to start it off by saying that reflecting on measure to me is really important. Just the word itself kind of draws me back and makes me contemplate on my actions and my expectations. And again, it's the attachment. When I start to feel frustration or anxiety or even happiness or whatever it is, it's largely to do with attachment. So I'm at the stage where I'm witnessing that and becoming aware of it. And I'm curious to how that will unfold for me. But just being in that stage of being aware of it, I feel that I can measure myself.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. I heard that people use meditation practice as a spiritual bypass means, but I was also curious about how does meditation practice relate with right speech, right action, and perhaps awareness of what one is doing, what I am doing, for example. Is there any correlation, or they are separate things?
Is there any what?
Correlation. Do they connect with each other? Does meditation practice has any influence on right speech, right action, or self-awareness?
What do you think, in your experience?
In my experience, it is so, but I have heard varied different perspectives. So I was wondering what's yours on the matter.
If meditation would not have an influence on these things, I would recommend to not practice that way. You know, if it really does not reflect, and again, this is where so much frustration also comes from. You know, we might be in a meditation retreat or so, you know, like, might really, to a certain extent, develop these skillful mind states. We can calm our mind and so on, you know. And then we come back to our daily life, and it's a matter of often short time, whatever that means. Few days, hours, weeks, months, where we kind of are back in our old, you know, habits. And then we need to retreat. This kind of famous retreat junkie phenomena, you know. Retreat, life. Retreat, life. And that's unsatisfactory to a certain extent. You know, that's why, for instance, and this is, be careful, maybe now a little advertisement, practices like when we try to take insight practice, vipassana, into communication, into our relationships with others. We can practice whatever nonviolent communication, insight dialogue, practices like this, where we don't try to separate, to alienate, this is a strong word, you know, our formal practice or Dharma practice so much from our normal life. Yeah, that we really try to integrate it, that it really reflects, influences, changes our lives. And that takes often time. Our minds are often far ahead in our way, the way we think or consider things, than when we what we can put into practice. This is so amazing, and to me, to a certain extent, nearly unbelievable, that it's said about the Buddha that for 45 years, from the day of his awakening to the day he passed away, there was no discrepancy whatsoever between what he was thinking, speaking, and acting. This is blows my mind, if that's true.
So to wrap it up, would that mean this, if spiritual bypass is observed, that would mean more practice would benefit that person
to skillful, deal with spiritual bypass? Skillful practice, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when we talk about practice, what do we mean by this? It's crucial, I think, you know. Because when we have an understanding, practice is like just sitting or walking, or I find often we limit our understanding of practice so tragically, you know. Skillful practice, I would say.
Thank you.
Is there some simple, easy way that Buddhism can, or I don't know, our practice or whatever, some easy principle to just use to address social injustice or, you know, society at large?
It's a big question. And when you look at the discourses, you know, the actions of the Buddha, with his incredible power to read or look into people's hearts and minds, sometimes the Buddha was very proactive in, for example, interfering and avoiding wars. Sometimes he did not interact because he seemed to know that whatever he does, it's not influencing other people's actions. So, when is it wise to act or not? You know, by turning away, you know, with a feeling, oh, I can't do anything, or I can't change anything, might be very selfish or very arrogant, very crude maybe. There is this, what you call, story of two men or women walking on the beach, and there are these shells or what, which were washed to the shore, to the sand, and they would die. So this one man or woman, you know, picks one up, throws them back into the water, and there's thousands of them. And the other person says, you know, how ridiculous, you know, it doesn't make any difference, you know, there's thousands of them. And then that person says, it makes a huge difference to this one. So, you know, what is skillful action? The amount of suffering in the world or worlds is endless. In the Mahayana tradition, you know, when you take that vow as a bodhisattva to, you know, care for all this suffering, to alleviate it, that's huge. Is that realistic or not? So what can you do in your life? It's a good question. A balance, you know, kind of, how much do I care for myself, how much do I care for others? Big question. I haven't figured that one out. I'm not the only one.
Thank you. I enjoyed your talk. I have a question. It seems, from what I've heard, I missed perhaps if you said something before we meditated because the train was late.
Can you put your
mic? Yes, but how would you define spiritual bypass? It seems like it is just the class complement of skillful, from, you know, everything that is. It seems like a very, very broad understanding. I had thought it would be, you know, more discreet, but it seems to just be what is not skillful.
I'm afraid I will not be able to offer you a kind of short, precise, that's the definition of spiritual bypass. Because, yeah, I don't have that skill or maybe understanding of it. But also what might be spiritual bypass for one person in one situation is not spiritual bypass for another, you know. Just by the external avoiding something, you cannot say that's spiritual bypassing, you know. If somebody, for example, chooses a celibate lifestyle, it might be spiritual bypassing, or it might be extremely skillful. It depends, you know. So you cannot, in my understanding, take as a measure stick a certain action, avoidance of certain things. It can be a spiritual bypass or not. It depends.
Thank you.
And who are we to judge for others? We are often very generous with that, you know. But
this notion is associated with a certain Tibetan, you know, with a certain Tibetan teacher who no longer with us, you know, that he coined that phrase, I believe.
Which phrase?
Spiritual bypass. Mm.
You surprise me now.
I wanted to thank you for talking about the precept about intoxicants that cloud the mind, but also mentioning what I heard as regular consumption, because I can take any kind of consumption, food, electronics, my own thinking, and that does have an intoxicating quality, and I've been reflecting on that more the more I hear the precepts. So it was extremely helpful to hear you talk about that in tandem, because I do not use substances, and I can get somewhat judgmental, I suppose, that this is a more quote-unquote sober existence. But I can be just as addicted to these other things that are not necessarily as chemically, physiologically addictive, but the reward system is just as activated in my brain. So thank you for that. It was a good thing for me to hear at this time.
I think quite a few teachers now take that really up as a serious topic, how to deal, for example, with electronic devices, you know. To demonize these things, or like TV or so, you know, is not wise, because it depends how you use it, you know. Like in monasteries where we make sometimes an effort, you know, for juniors to, you know, really give up their smartphones or computers and so, you can use these things in a very skillful way in terms of Dharma practice and study and exchange, you know. Like in the Insight Dialogue community, we use, you know, online practice, Zoom, Skype, whatever, FaceTime, you know. It depends how you use that. To say that's bad, that's wrong, that's foolish. Yeah. But to say you need to engage in this, that might be the other extreme, you know. So again, they how to find a skillful balance, you know. But I know from my own experience, it's so tempting, you know. It's so easy to, you know, entertain yourself with all kinds of stuff, which is, if it's not so bad, it's just a waste of time, but even that is a, you know, harmful influence, you know, not to mention if you engage in really harmful, violent stuff or disruptive stuff, you know. You know, when we fast, we get in touch with our attachment to food. So when we fast from these electronic devices in retreats, you know, or when we talk about noble silence. Is silence noble when we are asked not to speak and we have to be quiet? Is that noble? In my experience, often not, you know. But when the mind really wants to be quiet and not engage in these things, ah, what a relief. That has more a flavor of nobility. The Buddha, by the way, and again, this is not promoting, you know, or the end of silent retreats, you know, but when monks intensively practice for a period of 3 months and not talking. The Buddha was not impressed by that at all. You know, he actually scolded these monks. You get the impression often when monks, nuns, people practice intensively. The Buddha praised silence a lot, but he also strongly advised to engage in talk about Dhamma, you know, exchange about Dhamma, speak about Dhamma. And you get the impression that every couple of nights these practitioners were sitting together and talking about the practice for sometimes a long period of time. That's the impression one gets, you know.
Yeah. I'm sitting here and saying to myself, how would I know if I was spiritual bypassing? And I'm pretty much a beginner, so the answer would be my teacher. But then again, I'm the person who has to know this kind of thing. So I was thinking, does it essentially come from assuming you know something when you should not, when you should say, I don't know?
Good question. Very good question. Thank you for sharing this. Does anybody here in the room has a good answer for that?
I mean, I said maybe I have a good answer, but also I think the answer is maybe. Like, it, in some situations, it certainly could emerge from, like, the delusion of thinking you know or thinking I know when, in fact, I don't, because really, like, certainty is in and of itself a kind of illusion. I also think that in my experience, it comes from, and maybe this, like, this sort of conviction that some experience I'm having is unwholesome, like, say, a state of anger, that somehow that is innately unwholesome and therefore an impulse to sort of replace it with something more wholesome, and leaving aside the situations of, like, trauma or sort of harm coming from that. But I guess that would be a form also of, like, thinking I know what is better or needed. And that certainty or belief in certainty kind of closes off the opportunity to actually explore the arising of whatever the phenomena are that are uncomfortable or unpleasant that I wish to bypass. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know, or I'm curious. Might be a way to approach something, certainly in formal practice, but also in life, that doesn't bypass it, but allows it to be.
I mean, what comes to my mind is the richness when you have diversity in a community, in a residential community or in a practice community. And I think you know what I'm talking about. You know, when you have a diversity of views, of experiences, of levels of understanding, it really enriches everybody. Yeah. And when we all have the same opinion, all the same practice, all the same technique, then it's like, oh yeah, nice, you know, but what do we really learn? Often we learn through challenges, you know, through difficulties. Looking back, we can say yes, but when we are in it, often it's not yes, you know.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. One of the things that's coming up for me now is there were a lot of things that you talked about that I could really relate to. You were talking one time about, actually, I don't know if you said this, but I heard this, about a teaching or a teacher who doesn't particularly speak to one, or, you know, I had an experience where I went on a retreat twice with a teacher, and I just was totally freaked out by him, and just there were things that he was doing that were, I was just, it was like nuts. And he ended up passing away this past year, and it really hit me hard. And at that point, I don't know, somehow I just found myself very attracted to his teachings and to what he was. I wasn't able and in a position to listen to it then. But then was when he was gone, it just sort of was like, oh, this was, I needed this. Mm-hmm. And I think there was something that happened in my body that day that it just sort of settled in and I knew it. And it's like, this is right. And I had a similar experience. This was early on in my meditation practice. My grandmother was in a coma and she was dying. We knew she was going to die. And we would take turns being with her. And I would sit there and I'd listen to meditation tapes. And I kept listening to this one on grief. And it just, my mind was all over the place when I was listening to it. And I was like, this is not working. And I listened to one on gratitude. And all of a sudden, all this wave of emotion came. I thought I was supposed to be feeling grief, but really, this was a chance for me to feel gratitude. And at that moment I knew, okay, this is right, this is truth, it's fleeting. I could sense that in my body. I could feel a peace come across my mind and really hold it. So, thank you.
On the notion of gratitude, in our formal practice, when we make problems out of things which people who really suffer, for example, from starvation or serious health issues, like an experience of, I have to swallow in meditation, can become a big issue for a meditator, but for somebody looking from outside, what's the problem here? So sometimes the experience we are having and putting it into relation of what we are doing here and the suffering which we experience in the so-called, none of us, I guess, sitting here suffers from starvation. We have often the opposite problem, too much, choice or variety, and how do we... it's all relative, the suffering we experience, right? But the drama we often create in formal practice, because we take things so personal, me, mine, my practice, what should go away, how impatient we are often, Like the idea through practice, things should go away. Ultimately they do, but ultimately what time scale are we talking about? Few years, decades, lifetimes, When you keep cultivating the wholesome, it will have an effect sooner or later. But the truth for many of us is we are not patient enough. And maybe we are not so skilled in the way we apply the teachings. That's definitely true for me. Otherwise, I would suffer much less than I do now. So that feels bitter, but it's not harsh or crude against myself when I say that, or putting myself, disparaging myself, that's the reality to a certain extent. And I can be kind, try to be kind with that. Not justifying my unskillful behavior or my laziness or, how much I'm more interested in worldly things at times, That's the other thing, Take it easy. Don't strain yourself too much, When it gets painful, no, that's not the right way. That's another form of potential bypass. Avoid situations. And, the teachings, sorry, I might be a bit provocative here, Sooner or later, when we take the practice seriously, we will come into experiences which are really challenging, which are really unpleasant. When we come to experiences where the self starts to crumble, this idea of self, where deep, painful stuff will come up. I think that's part of the practice. So when we always make a serious effort to avoid these things, we stay maybe on quote-unquote safe grounds, but do we really transform dukkha in a real way? Questionable. We are entering, if we take practice serious, serious territory, you know, of challenging our usual life and understanding. Sometimes frightening. That's why it needs good friends, good teachers, good communities to practice with, for most of us.
I also want to thank you. I really enjoyed listening to you tonight. And, you know, I think my mind wanted to assign a word to the theme of what I was hearing. And what keeps coming into my head is humility. I mean, I'm hearing the description of humility as an action in so many different ways in what you spoke about. And I know for me in my personal, like, I don't think I would choose to have a practice of quieting my mind or trying to find quiet spaces in between my thoughts if it wasn't somehow going to prepare me for moments when I might be able to have that quietness if I've done something wrong. Like if I'm, you know, recently I was in a work situation and I was trying to fundraise, and I called out someone in a room who was the only person who didn't donate to the good cause, and he wrote me an email very angrily and was very upset that I called him out in front of other people. And, you know, getting an email with anger in it is a different experience than someone coming up to you and speaking to you, because those words are on the screen. And, you know, my first reaction was to be very defensive, and really I had to step back and apologize because I did that action, you know, even though if it was for a good cause. And I don't think I would have the ability in my life today to have those moments if I didn't have some sort of quiet practice where I was seeking this out. And it, for me, that always starts with humility. So, thank you.
And just not directly as a response to you, but of course, it makes a huge difference if we do something consciously, you know, like I now choose intentionally not to look at a certain thing because I need rest, I need quiet, I need peace. That might be a very wise, wonderful choice, you know, for this. It's not the ultimate, you know, everlasting, but at this time, place, what I need in this period of life or this for this meditation session is not to look at that what troubles me so much. You know, that's not spiritual bypass. It's a wise choice of cultivating the wholesome for that time, you know. And then when we have stabilized the mind again to a certain extent, then you can look again at that stuff. You know? Maybe one more person?
I have a complimentary question. So I think that was a, hopefully it's a good sequence. I was struck by when you mentioned, you know, a real test is not just your speech to other people, but if someone is coming at you, you know, in a related note with some real anger, or maybe here we're talking about harm that you might have done, but what if someone's coming to you and as far as you can tell, they're the aggressor? And it reminded me of a saying that I heard once of, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a weekend with your family. So if, you know, I think my question is, when do you wade into that water to take on that challenge? Just as it's wise to decide to step back and make sure you're getting your calm and recovery, I suppose you might say that life is going to throw things at you anyway, so just wait for it. But is there a time and a place, and how do you think about if you want to kind of wade into the water because you think, maybe I found a way to avoid the potholes and I'm walking down the right streets right now. When do I take on a challenge?
Again, wonderful territory you're addressing here, you know, to explore, you know. When it's a time to engage actively in going for the challenge, you know, look, how can I apply the teachings, the practice there, and when it's wise to, you know, step back from that or hold back. Very good. And we need to know for ourselves. Yes, sometimes, you know, other people might could give, offer good advice, you know, but what works for some person might not work for the other in the same way. It depends, again. I was asked to offer at the end of our time a few minutes for announcements or whatever. So before we do that, I really find it valuable, and this is in line with the Buddhist tradition, sometimes they practice what they call sharing the merits, you know, looking at what we have done here together tonight. You have heard a lot, some of the things you might agree or disagree, but I really invite you to take that up as an invitation to reflect for yourself on this. Reflect wisely, because this power of yoniso manasikara, wisely reflecting, this is like food for wisdom, for understanding, for knowledge, for liberation, ultimately. Don't underestimate that. Not kind of engaging in discursive thinking, but really wisely, deeply. And the other factor which the Buddha mentions for the arising of right view, right understanding, besides this deeply wise reflecting, is the what the could be literally translated as the voice of the other. Of course, ideally that's the voice of Dhamma, of truth, of that what is skillful, helpful, wise. So let us spend a minute or two in silence to reflect on if we have experienced that in your own mind, through what we heard. And let's intend to take that into our lives, that other people, few, many, countless beings might benefit from this. That qualities like kindness, compassion, joy, and sympathetic joy and equanimity might be lived and shared more and more in our lives. The more we engage, use these qualities, live these qualities, the bigger, the stronger they will become. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. I'd like to invite us to end this formal practice together with saying three times together, may there be peace. May there be peace. May there be peace. May there be peace. Thank you so much, and I'm not sure if you're going to mention the Sunday event also or not.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.